Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories, where we play tales to take you away from today. On the show today, we have a lot to get to. We have a question of character, a maid faces a horror, a calming reflection, and a malicious orb. And that's all in the first 20 minutes. Then we have our featured story, Project Hush, which is a big secret. We end the show with a brand new.
Johnny, is this true?
Now this is where I tell you that we have a 5-minute mystery, and we do, but I want to warn you that the quality on this one is poor, and that matches the silliness of the story. Here is Wise Guy Detective.
Another 5-minute mystery.
This 5-minute mystery is being brought to you by anyone who is a certified maniac. As we're about to hear, there are pretenders and there are those who obviously don't know the definition. Now, try to enjoy this story, but I will understand your frustration if you are, in fact, a maniac.
Sam Sloan, Detective Extraordinary.
This is Oliver Edgerton.
When a jewel collector calls a private detective, it only means one thing. Am I right?
If you're referring to robbery, yes, but it's more than that. Can you come over? I'll make it a large feat.
Open your door, client. I'll be there to greet you.
I don't see the need of calling in a private detective, Mr. Edgerton. After all, I'm the investigator for the insurance company.
That's the whole trouble, Maxwell. You've accused me of stealing my own diamond.
Take it nice and slow, Mr. Edgerton. What's the rap?
Last night, Mr. Sloan, my safe was broken into and one of my prized diamonds was taken.
Anything else touched?
That's the strange thing. Only this one diamond was stolen.
You must be dealing with a maniac.
Maxwell here is the investigator for the insurance company. He claims he has proof that I stole my own diamond so I could collect the insurance.
Well, I have.
It's the most preposterous charge I've ever heard. Your company, Maxwell, is just trying to get out of paying me the insurance.
What's the proof you claim to have, Maxwell?
This morning, after Mr. Edgerton phoned my company to report the robbery, I was sent out to investigate.
Never mind the embroidery. What are the facts?
I went into the garden and found footprints clearly outlined in the mud. You recall it rained last night.
Yeah, I remember. Go ahead.
I took plaster casts of the prints. Here they are.
Very pretty. What's the next exhibit?
See here, Sloan, are you going to permit him to go on with this nonsense?
I'm democratic. He's got a right to talk.
While Mr. Edgerton was away this afternoon, I went to his bedroom and found this pair of shoes. Didn't see for yourself that they have mud all over the sole.
Watch out, the mud's falling off.
My biggest proof is this. The plaster cast I made in the garden this morning fit these shoes exactly. The prints in the garden lead directly to the library, where the safe is located.
Those shoes were not in my closet this morning. I looked for them then.
There's your proof, Sloan. Edgerton stole the diamond so he could collect the insurance on it.
What did you do before you became an investigator for this insurance company, Maxwell?
Huh? What's the idea of that question?
Just wondering, that's all. Say, did you know it rained this afternoon? The prince in the garden must be gone.
Yes, I know it rained.
Will you stop discussing the weather, Mr. Sloan, and tell this man he's crazy?
He's not crazy, Mr. Edgerton. He knows what he's doing. You didn't steal that diamond, and he knows it.
What clue did Sam Sloan discover that proved Edgerton's innocence? In just a moment, we'll know, but first...
Must be dealing with a maniac, huh? For the record, a maniac is a person exhibiting extreme symptoms of wild behavior. Now, I don't know what you just heard, but I didn't hear any symptoms of madness. What I did hear was a completely implausible story with symptoms of complete silliness. Shall we go see if I'm right?
And now, back to our story.
You're talking through your hat, Sloan. Edgerton stole his own diamond.
You manufactured your own phony proof, Maxwell. Edgerton's shoes can't possibly be the ones that made those prints in the plaster cast. You see, any good investigator knows that anyone walking in mud makes a bigger impression than that of his shoes. The fact that the shoes and prints match proves that Edgerton never walked in that garden. You got hold of his shoes, made plaster casts, and then put some mud on them to make it look real. You didn't want to pay the insurance, Maxwell, but you'll have to pay a lot more. A comfortable, long jail sentence.
Well, our private detective was rather flippant in his description of the crime, but he was correct about one thing. The foot impression would be enlarged. However, it would also be reversed when collected and thereby restoring the perspective. I'm just saying. This mystery was brought to you by Maniacs Everywhere. I received this email from Samuel Butler, who writes to us from Flagstaff, Arizona. I gave Sam the opportunity to come on the show and ask his question in person. He declined, but was excited that I was going to read it on the show. Ron, I do like the show, but I have to say, the stories you read us from the listeners are far too amazing. I don't believe them, but I do like them. I am an editor. I know that that's your profession as well. As an editor, I know that each writer has a voice. One of the hardest things to do is to protect that voice so that it's not lost. I have to walk the thin line of getting it right and maintaining their perspective. Your stories have a style to them which suggests that either you are writing them or are editing them. What is the truth here? I understand if you don't want to answer this question to protect your secrets. Sam. Well, Sam, I don't have any secrets to protect. Straight answer? I do, in fact, edit the stories. I believe that I've said this on the show many times. I have to read them, and to do that, I have to make them comfortable to read. The tales I get, for the most part, are ready to go, but some are not. If I have to use a heavy hand to edit a story, I always send it back to the author for their approval. In the hundreds of stories that I've edited so far, only one was rejected. When I send a story back, one of two things happen. Either I never hear from them again, or they love the edits I made. It's that simple. If I don't hear back, I don't read the story. As to whether the tales are true or not, that's not for me to decide. I form my opinions about the stories on my own. It's up to you to decide how you feel about it. I will be honest and say I don't believe every story that has been sent in, but there are many times when I know that they are true and it cannot be explained. One last thing. I never embellish or change a story to make it more exciting or have a better ending. I just make them easier for me to read. Thank you, Sam, for asking this question. I appreciate your candid comment, and I hope you like my edits. #smileyface. Well, folks, this is the 399th episode of Ron's Amazing Stories. That means that next week we will play the 400th. That show has been a long time coming in more ways than one. It will include four brand new stories sent in by Margarito, Barbara, Scott, and my very own brother, Jim. Also, as an added treat, Jim Harold, host of Campfire, the Paranormal Podcast, and Podlords, will join me to co-host the show. It's going to be amazing and hopefully a whole lot of fun. To Margarito, Barbara, Scott, and Jim, thank you for being so patient. You waited nearly 4 months to get your stories aired. I can't wait. Not only is this the 400th episode, but it also marks the beginning of the month of Spooky 2019. There's so much to get to this month, you'll just have to join us to find out how it's going to happen. Being honest, I'm not even sure how it's all going to shake out. And now, this word from Audible. Today's podcast is being brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/Ron's Amazing Stories. They have over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, computer, Kindle. Whatever you have, you can listen to Audible on it. So what am I listening to right now? Science Fiction Favorites by Isaac Asimov, narrated by Isaac Asimov. Probably one of the greatest science fiction writers of our time. He wrote with such clarity and forethought that most of what he has written is coming to pass before our very eyes. Look at AI and robots today and know that this is true. Here is the opening to the book in Isaac's own words.
My name is Isaac Asimov, and I've been asked to read a few of my stories to you. I don't know which of my stories you like best, so what I've done is to pick out some of the stories I like and hope that you have the same tastes as I do. When I was teaching at school, the other members of the department knew, of course, that I wrote science fiction, and some of them would try to write some. I inspire people to write science fiction. They say, if that fellow can do it, I sure can. And one of them asked me how I made up my ideas, and I said, oh, it's simple, you just think a little. I said, for instance, if you want to write a science fiction story, why don't you write one about a time when people have forgotten arithmetic, and then someone discovers it again? And he said, that's a good idea. And on the way home, I thought about it, and I thought, why should I give him a good idea? So I called him up, I said, you can't have it. I want to write this story. And I did. And it's called The Feeling of Power. And this is the way it goes.
Now, if you want to hear that story and many others performed by Isaac himself, you can have Science Fiction Favorites today. Here is what Audible has set up for us. Audible is offering a free audiobook and 30 days to give you the opportunity to check out their service. To download Science Fiction Favorites today, go to audibletrial.com/Ron's Amazing Stories. Again, that's audibletrial.com/Ron's Amazing Stories, and you can get your free book today. Thank you, Audible. And now, it's time for your stories.
These are your stories, sent by you, for you.
Keep sending in your stories and I keep reading them. Just a reminder, if you want to tell your story yourself, that's always an option. Our first story came by telephone. Yes, that age-old contraption that allows you to speak to a person and hear for yourself what they have to say. This one comes from Detroit, Michigan. I had the pleasure to chat with Lori Phelps, who works for a maid service in the Motor City. As a maid, you never really are sure where you're going to work on any given day. They do have regulars and people that ask for them by name, but that's only part of the job. New clients are a daily occurrence, or perhaps they just hire you for a one-time cleanup. That was the case for Lori's story that she calls a cleaning horror. On my job sheet, I had a new listing for an antique shop in Midtown, actually one of the safest parts of the city, and I liked to work there. The job was a one-timer, and when I got there, it turned out to be a cleanup of a bathroom and three offices that had just been renovated. They were expanding the business to include movie prop sales and had hired new associates. When I arrived, it was already kind of strange. They told me that I was the third maid that had come to attempt the cleanup. I thought maybe the work was too much and asked them to show me what was needed. I was given a tour by the owner himself. As we walked through the building, he described what had been done and what was still needed. It was actually fairly light work. The offices just needed to be cleaned and organized, and the bathroom had been closed for some time, and it was a mess. I decided to start there, and within a few hours had the place spick and span. Before I moved on, I had the owner check my work, and he was very pleased. It was then he asked me if I'd heard any strange noises or had anything happen. I wasn't sure how to answer the question. Nothing strange had happened, but it was kind of icky. You get used to that as a maid. I moved on to the office. I'd been told that it had been used for storage for years and that it didn't smell right. That was an understatement. It stunk of old cigar, rotted animal remains, and who knows what else. It was fumigation that it needs, and I called to have one of the guys come do it. Until he arrived, I set about cleaning and, unfortunately, looking for what was causing the smell. It was then I heard the voice. I turned, thinking the owner had returned, but I was alone. I must be hearing things, I thought, and set back to work. It came again, a kind of moan, like someone was injured. I looked everywhere. I even had the thought that I was on some kind of candid camera thing. But I came up empty again. I was working around the new desk when I felt my head snap back like someone was pulling my hair. Ouch! I screamed. The voice came again. I was just about to run out of the room when Rob arrived and said, "Man, does this stink. You find the source?" I told him what had just happened, and he just laughed. That got me to thinking that I had imagined the whole thing. We searched the room again, and this time found a dead thing in the vent. I finished cleaning, and he fumigated the place. The smell was gone, and we left for the day. The next morning, I returned to finish the job. I went to the office where we had done the fumigation, and it smelled bright and wonderful. It also felt like a completely different place. The day before, there had been a heaviness that I couldn't explain. It was gone as well. Two offices to go. The next was straightforward. I cleaned and organized it and was quite pleased with my work. The owner stopped by and told me how much he appreciated what I had done thus far. It always feels good to have a customer say that. I set up in the last office, and that's where things went really screwy. No sooner had I begun to work when the lights went out. I walked over to the switch and it was turned off. I turned it back on and was trying to think of how and why when the desk chair rolled across the room by itself. No one was there and I felt a chill go through my body. I tried to shake it off and get back to work, but I wouldn't be staying any longer. I moved towards the desk and a shadow blocked my path. I felt it push hard on my chest, and I fell to the floor. Then I screamed. The owner and a few others came running in, asking if I was okay. I remember getting up and sprinting out of the room. I didn't stop there. I grabbed my stuff, went out the door, and made my way to the closest subway entrance. I never returned. Lori Phelps, Detroit, Michigan. Lori returned to the home office and was expecting to be chewed out for leaving. That didn't happen. All she was told was how happy the customers were with her work and that she was welcome back anytime. Later, she got curious and called the antique shop. She was told that the office was converted back to being a storeroom and nobody likes to go in there. Lori, it was a pleasure to chat with you and thank you for your story. It is amazing. Our second story comes all the way from Honolulu, Hawaii. While not all that far away, it seems like another world to me. A place I want to be. Our story is called Reflections of Me and was sent in by Bethany Hamilton. Hello, Ron. Thank you for the show. I have a short tale I hope you can use. Here it is. I was out walking in the local park. There are a lot of these greenways in Hawaii. We had just had a heavy rain, and that is my favorite time to walk because there's always standing water everywhere and things feel so clean. It was bright and sunny. As I walked, I had a strange sensation. I suddenly became aware that I was alive. I can't explain, but for an instant I knew that it was a fact. It was quickly replaced with another feeling that I wasn't alone. I looked around me, but there was no one there. I continued my walk, and I happened to glance over at a pool of water. Walking with me was a man. I couldn't make out any features, and the image wasn't reversed. By that I mean it looked like he was part of the water. I glanced up to look around me again, and I was still alone. I wasn't scared. In fact, I felt at peace. When I looked back to the pool once more, the image was gone. I told my husband what happened. He is a photographer and said it was just a trick of the bright sun and reflection, nothing more. I don't think so, but I don't know what I saw. Bethany Hamilton, Honolulu, Hawaii. Well, Bethany, I don't know what you saw either. Reflections can be a funny animal, but usually there is no doubt that they are just reflections. This seems like something more. Perhaps a passerby from another dimension. Who can say, except, thank you for your story. Our last story is another orb tale. And I've said this before, and I will say it again. Of all the paranormal type tales out there, these and Bigfoot are some of my favorites. It was sent in by Gennaro Winslow from Dayton, Ohio. Hey Ron, I want to tell you about my experience from a few years ago. I've told this story countless times, and I've even posted it online. Background: my dad's house is new. We built it ourselves. At the time this story takes place, it was barely a year old. Our land, however, is very old. We've seen ghosts there before, and lots of weird stuff happens. It's also a bit swampy. It goes from a grassy field to a swampy woods pretty fast on the south end of our land, and that is the area where my window faces. So, on with the story. I was 10 or 11 lying in bed one night. My dad was on a business trip, and I was home alone with my mom. Being a 10-year-old, I didn't really like sleeping all that much, but I was trying at least. I looked out my window above the forest, and I see a floating blue orb. The logical part of my brain kicks in. Is my uncle spotlighting a raccoon? No, it's a blue light, not a yellow-white light. What is this? I look at it for a minute before I run to get my mom. She was up late reading a novel, so I pulled her back into my room and told her to look at the orb. It, of course, had disappeared. She told me it was my overactive imagination and tucked me into bed again. I rolled over dejected, still unable to sleep. I'm going to guess about 10 minutes later, no clock, no phone, I look outside again and the orb is back. But a little closer. It's hovering in front of the trees and a bit lower. It's not any brighter, just closer. So I ran to get my mom again, who's still awake. By the time we get back to my room, it's gone again. This happened a few more times. Each time, the orb was getting closer. My mom had gotten very annoyed with me and told me not to bother her again after the fourth or fifth time. I'm still lying in bed looking out the window when it appears directly outside the glass. I'm frozen in fear. What is it? What did it want? Was it going to hurt me? Why? It floated through my window and into my room. It was an orb, but it was not completely illuminating my room. It was just a faint glow. It keeps floating closer to me until it's at the foot of my bed, and then I black out. I wake up some time later. The moon was still in the same general location, so not too long. I run to my window to see if the orb is still there, but instead I'm greeted with a flash of memory from some other time. A boy, my age, short blonde hair, green eyes, a smile, a storm, and darkness. The next thing I remember is hitting the floor and waking up the next morning. This isn't the first time I saw that boy. I've seen him before, in a dream, when I was a little girl. But I won't get into that here, since that was a dream and not a real encounter. I told my grandmother about the orb later on. She said she had a similar experience with a red orb. Gennaro Winslow, Dayton, Ohio. Amazing story, Gennaro. I've heard many stories about orbs, and none of them have ever been negative. This, you could argue, is borderline, but reading between the lines, I got the impression that you had a fondness for that boy in your dream. Also, the fact that your grandmother had a similar experience adds much to its credibility. Thank you for sharing your story with us. Do you have a story that you want to tell on the show? If you do, we want to hear it. It can be about any subject and from any genre. Heck, it doesn't even have to be true. Original fiction or stories from the public domain are quite welcome. To submit them, head to ronsamazingstories.com and click on the story submission banner. Fill out the form, and soon your story will be heard on the show. Do you have a story but don't want to write it? That's okay too. Just leave your contact information, a brief description of your story, and I'll get back to you. We can write it together. However, if you don't do it, your story remains just that, your story. Why not share it with the world and make it our story?
Ours Red Boy. Amazing stories read by amazing people.
This time on As Read By, we have an excellent story called Project Hush. It comes from Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, February 1954. If that sounds familiar to you, you have a sharp ear. This is the third story we've had from that issue. It must have been amazing. Our government is always being accused of being secretive. This story suggests a possible result of being maybe too secret. The tag for this one reads, "The biggest job in history, and it had to be done with complete secrecy." It was, which was just the trouble. Here is Project Hush, read for us by Daniel Gorzinski.
I guess I'm just a stickler, a perfectionist, but if you do a thing, I always say you might as well do it right. Everything satisfied me about the security measures on our assignment except one, the official Army designation. I don't know who thought it up, and I certainly would never ask, but whoever it was, he should have known better. Damn it, when you want a project kept secret, you don't give it a designation like that. You give it something neutral. Some name, like the Manhattan and Overlord they used in World War II, which won't excite anybody's curiosity. But we were stuck with Project Hush, and we had to take extra measures to ensure secrecy. A couple of times a week, everyone on the project had to report to Psycho for DD and HA, dream detailing and hypnoanalysis, instead of the usual monthly visit. Naturally, the commanding general of the heavily fortified research post to which we were attached could not ask what we were doing under penalty of court-martial. But he had to be given further instructions to shut off his imagination like a faucet every time he heard an explosion. Some idiot in Washington was actually going to list Project Hush in the military budget. By name! It took fast action, I can tell you, to have it entered under Miscellaneous X Research. Well, we'd covered the unforgivable blunder, though not easily. And now we could get down to the real business of the project. You know, of course, about the A-bomb, H-bomb, and C-bomb, because information that they existed had been declassified. You didn't know about the other weapons being devised, and neither did we. Reasonably enough, since they weren't our business. but we had been given properly guarded notification that they were in the works. Project Hush was set up to counter the new weapons. Our goal was not just to reach the moon. We had done that on 24th of June 1967 with an unmanned ship that carried instruments to report back data on soil, temperature, cosmic rays, and so on. Unfortunately, it was put out of commission by a rock slide. An unmanned rocket would be useless against the new weapons. We had to get to the moon before any other country did and set up a permanent station, an armed one, and do it without anybody else knowing about it. I guess you see now why we on, damn the name, Project Hush were so concerned about security. But we felt pretty sure before we took off that we had plugged every possible leak. We had, all right. Nobody even knew we had raised ship. We landed at the northern tip of Mare Nubium, just off Regiomontanus, and after planting a flag with appropriate throat-catching ceremony, had swung into the realities of the tasks we had practiced on so many dry runs back on Earth. Major Monroe Gridley prepared the big rocket with its tiny cubicle of living space for the return journey to Earth, which he alone would make. Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Hawthorne painstakingly examined our provisions and portable quarters for any damage that might have been incurred in landing. And I, Colonel Benjamin Rice, first commanding officer of Army Base Number 1 on the Moon, dragged crate after enormous crate out of the ship on my aching academic back and piled them in the spot 200 feet away where the plastic dome would be built. We all finished at just about the same time as per schedule and went into phase 2. Monroe and I started work on building the dome. It was a simple prefab affair, but big enough to require an awful lot of assembling. Then, after it was built, we faced the real problem: getting all the complex internal machinery in place and in operating order. Meanwhile, Tom Hawthorne took his plump self off in the single-seater rocket, which, up to then, had doubled as a lifeboat. The schedule called for him to make a rough 3-hour scouting survey in an ever-widening spiral from our dome. This had been regarded as a probable waste of time, rocket fuel, and manpower, but a necessary precaution. He was supposed to watch for such things as bug-eyed monsters out for a stroll on the lunar landscape. Basically, however, Tom's survey was intended to supply extra geological and astronomical meat for the report which Monroe was to carry back to Army HQ on Earth. Tom was back in 40 minutes. His round face, inside its transparent bubble helmet, was fish belly white. And so were ours, once he told us what he'd seen. He had seen another dome. The other side of Mare Nubium, in the Riphaen Mountains, he babbled excitedly. It's a little bigger than ours, and it's a little flatter on top, and it's not translucent either, with splotches of different colors here and there. It's a dull, dark, heavy gray. But that's all there is to see. No markings on the dome? I asked worriedly. No signs of anyone or anything around it? Neither, Colonel. I noticed he was calling me by my rank for the first time since the trip started, which meant he was saying, in effect, "Man, have you got a decision to make?" "Hey, Tom," Monroe put in. "Couldn't be just a regularly shaped bump in the ground, could it?" "I'm a geologist, Monroe. I can distinguish artificial from natural topography. Besides," he looked up, "I just remembered something I left out. There's a brand new tiny crater near the dome. The kind usually left by a rocket exhaust." "Rocket exhaust," I seized on that. "Rockets, eh?" Tom grinned a little sympathetically. "Spaceship exhaust, I should have said. You can't tell from the crater what kind of propulsive device these characters are using. It's not the same kind of crater our rear jets leave, if that helps any." Of course it didn't. So we went into our ship and had a council of war. And I do mean war. Both Tom and Monroe were calling me Colonel in every other sentence. I used their first names every chance I got. Still, no one but me could reach a decision about what to do, I mean. Look, I said at last, here are the possibilities. They know we are here, either from watching us land a couple of hours ago or from observing Tom's scout ship. Or they did not know we are here. They are either humans from Earth, in which case they are in all probability enemy nationals, or they are alien creatures from another planet, in which case they may be friends, enemies, or what have you. I think common sense and standard military procedure demand that we consider them hostile until we have evidence to the contrary. Meanwhile, we proceed with extreme caution so as not to precipitate an interplanetary war with potentially friendly Martians or whatever they are. All right, it's vitally important that Army headquarters be informed of this immediately. But since Moon-to-Earth radio is still on the drawing boards, the only way we can get through is to send Monroe back with the ship. If we do, we run the risk of having our garrison force, Tom and me, captured while he's making the return trip. In that case, their side winds up in possession of important information concerning our personnel and equipment, while our side has only the bare knowledge that somebody or something else has a base on the moon. So our primary need is more information. Therefore, I suggest that I sit in the dome on one end of a telephone hookup with Tom, who will sit in the ship, his hand over the firing button, ready to blast off for Earth the moment he gets the order from me. Monroe will take the single-seater down to the Riffane Mountains, landing as close to the other dome as he thinks safe. He will then proceed the rest of the way on foot, doing the best scouting job he can in a spacesuit. He will not use his radio, except for agreed-upon nonsense syllables to designate landing the single-seater, coming upon the dome by foot, and warning me to tell Tom to take off. If he's captured, remembering that the first purpose of a scout is acquiring and transmitting knowledge of the enemy, he will snap his suit radio on full volume and pass on as much data as time and the enemy's reflexes permit. How does that sound to you? They both nodded, and as far as they were concerned, the command decision had been made. But I was sitting under 2 inches of sweat. One question, Tom said. Why did you pick Monroe for the scout? I was afraid you'd ask that, I told him. We're three extremely unathletic PhDs who have been in the Army since we finished our schooling. There isn't too much choice, but I remember that Monroe is half Indian. Arapaho, isn't it, Monroe? And I'm hoping blood will tell. Only trouble, Colonel, Monroe said slowly as he rose, is that I'm 1/4 Indian, and even that, didn't I ever tell you that my great-grandfather was the only Arapaho scout who was with Custer at the Little Bighorn? He'd been positive Sitting Bull was miles away. However, I'll do my best. And if I heroically don't come back, would you please persuade the security officer of our section to clear my name for use in the history books? Under the circumstances, I think it's the least he could do. I promised to do my best, of course. After he took off, I sat in the dome over the telephone connection to Tom and hated myself for picking Monroe to do the job. But I'd have hated myself just as much for picking Tom. And if anything happened, and I had to tell Tom to blast off, I'd probably been sitting here in the dome all by myself after that, waiting. Brosnegi, came over the radio in Monroe's resonant voice. He had landed the single-seater. I didn't dare use the telephone to chat with Tom in the ship, for fear I might miss an important word or phrase from our scout. So I sat and strained my ears. After a while, I heard Mishgashu, which told me that Monroe was in the neighborhood of the other dome and was creeping toward it under cover of whatever boulders were around. And then abruptly, I heard Monroe yell my name, and there was a terrific clattering in my headphones. Radio interference! He'd been caught, and whoever had caught him had simultaneously jammed his suit transmitter with a larger transmitter from the alien dome. Then there was silence. After a while, I told Tom what had happened. He just said, "Poor Monroe." I had a good idea of what his expression was like. "Look, Tom," I said, "if you take off now, you still won't have anything important to tell. After capturing Monroe, whatever's in that other dome will come looking for us, I think. I'll let them get close enough for us to learn something of their appearance, at least if they're human or non-human. Any bit of information about them is important. I'll shout it up to you, and you'll still be able to take off in plenty of time, all right?" "You're the boss, Colonel," he said in a mournful voice. "Lots of luck." And then there was nothing to do but wait. There was no oxygen system in the dome yet, so I had to squeeze up a sandwich from the food compartment in my suit. I sat there thinking about the expedition. 9 years and all that careful secrecy, all that expenditure of money and mind-cracking research. And it had come to this, waiting to be wiped out in a blast from some unimaginable weapon. I understood Monroe's last request. We often felt we were so secret that our immediate superiors didn't even want us to know what we were working on. Scientists are people. They wish for recognition, too. I was hoping the whole expedition would be written up in the history books, but it looked unpromising. 2 hours later, the scout ship landed near the dome. The lock opened, and from where I stood in the open door of our dome, I saw Monroe come out and walk toward me. I alerted Tom and told him to listen carefully. It may be a trick. He might be drugged. He didn't act drugged, though. Not exactly. He pushed his way past me and sat down on a box to one side of the dome. He put his booted feet up on another, smaller box. "How are you, Ben?" he asked. "How's every little thing?" I grunted. "Well," I know my voice skittered a bit. He pretended puzzlement. "Well, what?" "Oh, I see what you mean. The other dome. You want to know who's in it?" "You have a right to be curious, Ben, certainly. The leader of a top-secret expedition like this, Project Hush, they call us, huh, Ben? Finds another dome on the moon? He thinks he's been the first to land on it, so naturally he wants to. Major Monroe Gridley," I rapped out, "you will come to attention and deliver your report now." Honestly, I felt my neck swelling up inside my helmet. Monroe just leaned back against the side of the dome. "That's the Army way of doing things," he commented admiringly. "Like the recruits say, there's a right way, a wrong way, and an Army way. Only there are other ways, too," he chuckled. "Lots of other ways." "He's off," I heard Tom whisper over the telephone. "Ben, Monroe is gone and blown his stack." "They aren't extraterrestrials in the other dome, Ben," Monroe volunteered in a sudden burst of sanity. "No, they're human, all right, and from Earth. Guess where?" "I'll kill you," I warned him. "I swear I'll kill you, Monroe. Where are they from? Russia? China? Argentina?" He grimaced. "What's so secret about those places? Go on, guess again." I stared at him long and hard. "The only place else..." "Sure," he said. "You got it, Colonel. The other dome is owned and operated by the Navy. The damn United States Navy." End of Project Hush by William Ten.
Pretty good story, I thought. A bit dated, and in fact, we didn't actually reach the moon until 1969. However, when you think about it, the author, William Ten, was much more in tune with the times than others from the 50s. Some of those guys had us flying around the stars in atomic rockets. William Ten was the pen name of Philip Klass. He was a British-born American science fiction author, noted for many stories with satirical elements. like our story today. Class published academic articles, essays, 2 novels, and more than 60 short stories. He began writing while working at Bell Labs, and it was his radar lab experience that prompted his first story, Alexander the Bait, which is about a radar beam aimed at the moon. I'm going to have to read this one, if I can find it. So far, I've had no luck tracking it down. Do you have a copy of Astounding Science Fiction, May 1946? If you do, let's talk.
Johnny, is this true?
Okay, I like to surf the internet looking for stories and other oddities. I do this in the name of the podcast, but the truth is, it's fun to see what's out there. What you're about to hear is what I call...
Johnny, is this true?
I will tell you a story and then ask the question. Did I make it up or is it true? Let's get started.
Johnny, is this true?
This time we examine some random facts of strangeness. I hope you enjoy it. Story 1. We all know that during World War II, prisoners were taken and held on neutral ground until it ended in 1945. Of course, at that time, they were released and sent back home. However, for 6,000 Germans held in Canada, they refused to leave. Now, is this a fact, or did I just dream it up? Strange, but true. Of the 35,046 German soldiers, sailors, airmen, and potential insurgents that were incarcerated in Canada during World War II, a whopping 6,000 didn't want to leave after the war ended. At these Canadian camps, prisoners were given paying jobs and were able to enjoy handball, boxing, wrestling, gymnastics, tennis, skating, and more. There was also mutual respect and trust between the guards and the prisoners. Shockingly, some guards would even loan prisoners their rifles to go hunting. No wonder one prisoner referred to his time there as the best thing that ever happened to me. Story 2. How much do you like your cereal? Would you be willing to pay $1,300 for it? Well, according to eBay, a single flake of Kellogg's Corn Flakes did in fact sell for that amount. Now, is this a hoax or a very special piece of corn? If you said this was real, you got it right. In 2008, 2 Virginia sisters found a single cornflake that was shaped like the state of Illinois and sold it on eBay for $1,350. Monty Kerr, the owner of a trivia site from Austin, Texas, was the buyer and explained that he wanted the special piece of cereal for his traveling museum. "We're starting a collection of pulp culture and Americana items," he told the Associated Press. "We thought this was a fantastic one." Story 3. How about this one? Did I make this one up? Do you know what the most common cause of power outages are in the United States? Would you believe me that if I told you it's the cute and furry ground squirrel that does all this damage? Well, it's true. The American Public Power Association says that squirrels are the most frequent cause of power outages in the United States. The APPA have even developed a data tracker called the Squirrel Index that analyzes the patterns and timings of squirrels' impact on electrical power systems. Turns out that the peak times of the year for squirrel attacks are from May to June and October to November. How about that? Story 4. We all like to look up and enjoy a good cloud. They can be so very pretty and can set our imaginations a-going, trying to figure out what they remind us of. But did you know that that cloud only weighs about 10 pounds? Is that right? Oh, heck no. I totally fudged that one. Clouds are not as light and fluffy as they appear. In fact, researchers have found that a single cloud weighs about 1.1 million pounds. How do they know? Well, that number is calculated by taking the water density of a cloud and multiplying it by its volume. Fortunately, the cloud can still float at that weight because the air below is even heavier. That is our strange and true facts for this time. I hope you enjoyed this edition of Johnny Is It True? And remember to watch your squirrels and don't stand under a cloud. Johnny Is It True? Was brought to you by Gladys Goodies. Good treats for your dog to eat. They use natural products with no added sugars, preservatives, salts, or harmful ingredients. So check out their online store at GladysGoodies.com. That's GladysGoodies.com. Oh, and don't forget to use our very own promo code RONS to get a 20% discount on all of your purchases. That is RONS. Thank you, Glady.
And now, Toby Reed with a word to something that is really a matter of life and death. And that is, Toby?
A blowout, Walter. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, a blowout in one of the tires on your automobile. Did you ever stop to think that if you're driving at today's top speed of 35 miles an hour and a blowout swerves your car into an oncoming truck, which travels at the same speed, the resulting crash has a force of 70 miles an hour. Now, that's enough to double you right over the steering wheel and push the engine through the dash. Yet there is actually no need for a blowout to throw your car out of control. Not if the car is equipped with Goodyear lifeguards. For the lifeguard is an inner tire, a two-ply safety tire within a tube. It replaces the conventional inner tube, and if your outer tire and tube blow, the inner tire of the lifeguard remains inflated, holds the car steady so you can come to a sure, safe stop. That's the kind of blowout protection your family needs, and such sure protection it is that never once has a lifeguard been reported to fail. Never once. Think it over. Ask your Goodyear dealer if he has any of the few lifeguards now available. If so, equip your car with lifeguards, which are now ration-free. For remember, when your tire blows out, the Goodyear lifeguard never lets you down.
Is it true we've completed another podcast? It is. This time we have to thank Samuel Butler, Lori Phelps, Bethany Hamilton, Gennaro Winslow, and Daniel Gorzinski for making this one happen. Truly amazing. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, just head to ronsamazingstories.com. There you will find an amazing number of links that should fit every need. Do you want to help the show? The best thing you can do is to tell your friends about it, and please leave reviews or feedback wherever you listen. This really does help us to grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.
All of the vintage audio used in the podcast is believed to be in the public domain. Ron's Amazing Stories does not own the rights to any of the old-time radio used here. If you hold the rights to any of the shows played, please contact us immediately at ronsamazingstories.com.